Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Communication and Journalism Department, preparing the students of today for the complex world of tomorrow. On the season premiere of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska.
When I reached him, I realized he was gone. I didn't have much experience with death, but there's a life force in certain people when it leaves them. There's no question. I didn't feel for a pulse. I remember that. And I kind of regret that. But it wasn't any doubt in my mind. At that point, it was just a matter then of getting myself out before I froze to death.
Welcome to Season 3 of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. I'm Rob Prince. For those of you who have been following the program over the years, you know that last year we took a little bit of a hiatus while I was away on academic sabbatical. But I'm back, and we're starting up the live program and the radio program and the podcast again. And I wanted to kick off Season 3 of Dark Winter Nights with one of the most incredible stories we've ever had on the program. Mike Hopper shared this amazing avalanche story at our 2015 April live show. Here's Mike Hopper.
Something's changing in the Alaska Range, but I'm not going to talk to you about avalanches. I'll tell you what it's like to survive one, but I'm going to talk to you about a dog. We got my dog Rowdy around the same time that we were scheduled to open our lodge in Black Rapids. I'm going to assume most of you know where that is. It's not the Parks Highway, it's the other highway. This beautiful place called Isabel Pass. And I had waited a few years now to get a dog. I picked him up out of a litter of about 10 puppies with about 10 little kids running around in the parking lot of Fred Meyer's. And I'll never forget, from the moment I had him in the front of my Dodge truck, he curled up next to me and promised never to go away. He was the dog every boy deserves, no matter how old you are. I couldn't have trained him to do the things he did at our lodge. He would take people out for walks and hikes in the woods and not come back without them. He had a way of begging that made you feel gifted to give him something. But most of all, Rowdy loved to ski. I'm a backcountry skier, which is kind of a, it's sort of like a hermit skier. You value the solitude of the mountains as much as you do your turns. But Rowdy broke that solitude. As a pup, he wasn't even a year old when I first took him out in the mountains of Isabel Pass. Back then, he was so small still that he'd kind of disappear in the snow. But even then, he would race me down the hill. And I was on skis. I remember the first time I took him was just an experiment. I didn't know if he'd plunge up to his shoulders in snow, but he had big feet, and from day one, I knew I had the right dog. We had this one of those first winters where, if you can remember a couple years back, where it rained mid-January. Do you remember that? That was the first time I ever saw avalanches in Isabel Pass. They came down the next day like huge masses of porridge. They were just everywhere. I'd never seen anything like it. It destroyed our skiing for that year. So a year coming up to the following winter, this is 2014, the winter of 2014-15, we were snow-starved. We hadn't had any skiing, spring skiing the year before to speak of. And I was just chomping at the bit to go, as was Rowdy. About a month later, I get a call, or a text actually, from my friend Eric Peterson. 7 inches of fresh snow at Trimskew Camp. We're on. he came running down the next morning, bright-eyed, big, huge, muscular, 35-year-old guy, and just one of the most amazing mountaineers I've ever known. It's December 6th, so it really was a dark winter tale. There's not much sunlight, and what there is pretty flat. We don't care. We haven't skied in over a year. So we started up this little draw, this little pass. It's sort of a notch in Rainbow Ridge, those of you who know the area. It's a big sweeping ridge, right? And there's a notch at the end and another peak. Up through that notch takes you some of the most easily accessible and beautiful skiing in the Isabel Pass area. We ski it all the time as our first, usually for our first runs, because you can get high real fast, and I mean legally. And the snow stays, right, and comes there earliest. So that was always one of our first early season ski areas. The pass is, it's a notch kind of through the hills, and as you approach the crest of this little notch, this little pass into the another drainage, there's a side valley that shoots off. Now you have to kind of stay with me on this part because I've got to describe it for you. So you get up over that notch, up that pass, and then you turn left up that valley, this side valley. And as you go up this side valley, to your right, maybe 1,500, 2,000 vertical feet, is a ridge, right? The side of the valley. And there are these spines coming down, creating all these little side valleys. Does that make sense? So they're all coming down. And the cool part about this is you can go up, you can ski all those spines. There's like three or four different little valleys as you go up. And this valley you're going up ends in a big, huge bowl at the end. So the area really calls to skiers because you can ski almost anywhere and anything, depending on your skill level and what the snow looks like. I'd done it many, many times. We were nervous, a little nervous going up it. But we kept poking the snow, which is what you do in the backcountry, to sort of test for its stability as you go. And the further up we got, the deeper the snow got and the more solid it seemed to us. As you get to the far end and you reach this bowl, you then have to cut. There's one last spine coming down. It marks the end of this ridge here and the beginning of this big, huge bowl. And you have to kind of hug your way up around that far side of this spine coming down, if that makes sense. We'd begun that final approach. We were from coming up out of the valley floor up to the top is probably maybe a half a mile, three quarters of a mile, final ski up. We had gone about maybe two-thirds of the way up that final approach, and it started to steepen. Just as it did that, my friend Eric, who was in front like he always was, noticed something different about the snow, and he drew my attention to it. Underneath this new 6 inches of fresh snow we had was a layer, like a chunky layer of almost yellow, looked like yellow hardened sort of snow. We hadn't seen anything like that down lower, and we both were pretty nervous at that point. We both were pretty experienced backcountry skiers and did not like the feel of it. We started talking immediately about hugging this spine that we were contouring up next to, hugging closer to that, because we noticed as you got to the snow on the spine, it was all good, that little layer. That hardened layer is what snow can slide on. Any snow that falls on top of it at a certain angle is prone or vulnerable to sliding off, so it causes avalanches. So we weren't completely unaware that we were in a dangerous situation. We were just trying to mitigate the danger by hugging this spine. It wasn't 3 minutes, 4 minutes after we'd noticed that change in the snow. As we were cutting back over towards this spine, it was steep enough we had to do little switchbacks, so we were trying to stay close to the spine. As we started cutting back over to it, we heard a distant whoomph. We both instinctively knew what it was. If you've ever been backcountry skiing, it's a sound you don't like to hear. But you could barely hear it. What it was the sound of a layer of snow that had been precariously perched on a fragile layer beneath it. collapsing. When it collapses, if you're on a steep enough angled slope, that's how avalanches start. So you have this thing, this layer of snow collapse and then slides. My friend Eric was ahead, about 20 feet of me, and Rowdy was right behind him. And I remember his words were, "Did you hear that? It was that distant." In the time it took for me to register what he'd said, I turned back and looked uphill. I was further out on the slope, the bowl slope, looking uphill at the uphill horizon. In the time it took for me to notice him and ask that question and turning my vision back up, I saw a 12-inch whitewater appear upslope about 20, 25 feet of me. It looked like a whitewater wave. I knew immediately what it was. I also knew I was toast. I had been knocked over two seasons before by a very small side thing, and I remembered how unbelievably powerless I felt, and I knew there wasn't anything I was going to do. Besides, I had skins on my skis still. I was pointing uphill, kind of sideways to this wave coming at me. I couldn't outrun it. I couldn't do anything. I was going to be, and I knew it, a tree chopped down right at the ankles and over. That wasn't my worry. I saw the whitewater wave appear, and as I turned back to my friend, I saw Rowdy bolting for all he was worth for the safety of that spine. But even by then, in the time it took me to turn my head back towards him, the wave had already caught up with his hindquarters, so I knew he was engulfed. What was amazing about the whole experience is how fast your mind works under these circumstances. So I was registering my chances, everything. I looked, I saw Rowdy. My last words to my friend Eric were, "Watch Rowdy, watch for Rowdy." I only had time to say it once. I thought he was safe. He was over closer to the spine, further uphill. I thought he was out of the path of this avalanche. By dint of me switchbacking toward the slope, I knew I was toast. But I had a beacon on. I figured he'd find me. I knew Rowdy didn't have a beacon. I wanted to make sure he kept eyes on Rowdy, get him first, and then come for me. That was my thinking. I don't remember being hit by the avalanche, though I must have. This was what was called a soft snow avalanche. Remember, this was brand new snow. This was some of the first snow of the season. So it hadn't been wind affected yet, hadn't turned into a hard, compact thing like the recent avalanches down at Arctic Man in April. This was soft snow, but a slab. I mean, it was still all collapsed and all started coming. The whoomph we heard, that distant whoomph, was the fact that it actually fractured. That means it broke away from the existing snow far up on a ridge, probably 400 or 500 yards upslope from us. We'd walked right into it. Bomb. I remember getting knocked down. I don't remember being impacted. My next memory really is of sliding on my stomach in total darkness. Like head first, right? Just sliding downhill, moving super fast. And I remember going through a checklist of all the things I'd learned in avalanche classes, what you're supposed to do if you get caught. The first was swim, right? Swim to the surface. Well, it's like swimming in white water, the snow I was in anyway. So it took me a split second to realize that was a dumb idea. I wasn't going anywhere. I mean, there was no purchase. It was like fluff around me, like black fluff. The next thing I remember was one of the things that saved my life. It was to keep the area in front of your face clear. So I, not knowing what else to do and sliding for all I was worth, I started just doing this frantically, just in front of my face, just keeping the area in front of my face clear. I also remembered that snow packs in any orifice. So I remember going like this, squeezing my eyes as tight as I could and shut my mouth as tight as I could. The slide went on forever. I was conscious the entire time and realized, I mean, I was going through calculations like for how long this could go, where I was on the mountain. And my only fear really was if it went too long, I would end up in the bottom of the valley, buried beyond recovery, right? It's called the terrain trap, where you go down the snow and then it just keeps piling on top if you hit the bottom of the valley. So the only worry I had, and this is really kind of odd, the only worry I had was it going to stop or would I get all the way to the bottom? If I got to the bottom, I knew I was dead. And it was with a kind of quiet certainty I accepted that fact, but I was certainly praying to stop. And sure enough, slowly it stopped. The minute it stopped, when it slowed and then it stopped, I went like this. And I just shoved all the snow that I'd been keeping away from my face, away from my face. And I was completely confident that I would find air. I had absolutely no reason to expect that when I look back now. But I knew I was, if it stopped, I was okay. I had this certainty about it. And I was. I went like this, and there was air. I took a huge first breath in. By the way, one thing interesting, you're not aware when you're sliding like that you're holding your breath. I had no awareness of like that. It was just, please stop, because if you don't, I'm dead. But there wasn't ever a panic about losing my breath or not having enough air. When I stopped, though, man, I tried to take a huge breath. I ended up sucking in a huge mouthful of snow. I don't know how that happened because I had my mouth shut the whole time. Spit that out. Notice there's a bunch of blood on it. I didn't know where that came from. But then took a lung full of air. And, you know, then tried to assess my situation. What I found was, even though it felt like I was just slid in my stomach the whole way down and was going like this, I ended up propped upright slightly at an angle. The snow was over my head, and I had a kind of window was what I'd been able to shove snow out of. It took me a little bit to realize, well, I didn't realize at first. I kept trying to shovel more because all I had was my face clear. Everything, this hand was free and everything else was pinned. I shoveled snow out. I tried to shove it up, but it was like being in a buried in sand. It all kind of started sliding in on me. At that point, I figured, okay, I can't get myself out. And I noticed I had a ski pole on my hand, on my right wrist, the one that was free. I took it off and I reached up as far as I could and I stuck the ski pole out. I was convinced my friend was still free. I didn't know about Rowdy, but I was sure my friend was free. I tried yelling once, but the sound doesn't carry real gear when you're buried in snow. And so I waited a couple minutes, and then I started to dawn on me that if someone was going to do rescuing, it might well have to be me. So I started trying to dig my way out with one hand. And it didn't last very long because the snow kept falling in my face and burying me. And at that point, I remembered I had that ski pole. So I reached back out and I grabbed the ski pole back in and found that if I took the little basket end of the ski pole, I could shove that much of snow away from where I was trying to dig myself out. What I began to realize slowly is that I had ended up near the leading edge of the avalanche. I didn't know how big it was until I got out. But what had happened is I was able to punch a window out to the front leading edge. If I'd been back a foot further, I couldn't have done what I did. You have to have some place to push the snow. So over the next couple hours, I've estimated, I was able to shove little, you know, big tablespoons of snow away as I dug away with my right hand. Slowly, I was able to dig enough away to where I could reverse the ski pole, chop myself out, free my upper body, reach behind, grab a snow shovel. By that point, I knew I was good, dug myself out. I did manage to wrench my knee in the process because I started getting cramps. That's how long it took. So I tried to pull my feet out of my ski boot, and that didn't work. But I finally was able to get down, dig down to my feet, where I discovered that I still have my skis on, which is another thing that saved me. I bent down, finally was able to unclip and crawl out of my hole. I immediately put everything I had on because I was pretty hypothermic. Went to look for my avalanche beacon, stumbled around to turn to receive so you could find out where Eric was. And I looked uphill, and about 20 feet away from me, I saw a black spot in the snow. I scrambled over to it. It was my friend's ski glove. He had done what I did, essentially. He was trying to reach for the surface. He could just reach the surface. We were both buried similarly. I dug down, but I sort of knew. I mean, it had been 2.5 hours to by that point. When I reached him, I realized he was gone. I didn't have much experience with death, but there's a life force in certain people when it leaves them. There's no question. I didn't feel for a pulse. I remember that. And I kind of regret that, but it wasn't any doubt in my mind. At that point, it was just a matter then of getting myself out before I froze to death. I don't remember much of the ski out. I went back and dug the rest of my skis out, put them on. I had a headlamp. I'd always ski with a headlamp. It was dark by the time I started out, so we left. We started at 10:30. I think the avalanche hit around 1:30. I think it was probably around 4:30 by the time I started out. Give you a timeline. And I made it to the highway. I looked very briefly for my dog, but I knew I couldn't find him, and I thought to say goodbye. It took hours to get a ride. The key to the truck was with Eric. And I ended up at the emergency room and on and on. Well, the troopers had called in an avalanche expert for Valdez next day or so. I was in touch with her, and we called off the immediate search the night of the avalanche. I warned them all off because the place had freaked me out, and I knew it was dangerous to go up there. And the troopers, and following some advice, they basically cordoned off the area and told nobody to go in. And they told us that it would be summer or spring when they could go to a recovery, which wasn't what I wanted to hear. So on the 21st, true beginning of winter, a buddy of mine, a former captain from the training center next door, who was on his honeymoon at the lodge, and I went up to reconnoiter to see what conditions looked like. Long story short, we scared ourselves into getting there, and we found the spot where Eric was buried. I had marked it with an avalanche probe. We discovered at that time the true extent of the avalanche. It wasn't just one avalanche that broke up above us on that side of the spine. It broke also, the fracture continued up high and continued off. The adjoining valley was two huge avalanches came together. The fact that my avalanche, our avalanche, beat the other one down is another reason I was able to save my life. If this side had come down first and we hit the side of it, I wouldn't have made it either. So there, I shouldn't be standing in front of you on any number of accounts. We dug down to find my friend. And true to his nature, you could tell from his slide and the position of his body that he had fought the whole way down. I knew when I saw the thing having been knocked over, it was useless to fight, but he was bigger and stronger and maybe more aggressive than I was. He fought the whole way down. What was surprising, and if there's any grace in the story, was the fact that as we got close and we got his upper body uncovered, we found Rowdy. Rowdy was curled up against Eric's back. And in front of his face was a cave, like a iced over cave. If I'd been completely buried and could never get snow, I might have been able to keep a cave in front of my face. The problem is, as you breathe and exhale, it coats that cave with ice, and you can't pull the oxygen from the snow any longer, and you slowly go to sleep and die. Well, my friend Rowdy, curled up against Eric's back, had dug a cave with his front feet, and from the expression on his face and his position, I could tell that he'd just gone to sleep. The other thing I took some solace in, and I do to this day, was that his right paw was on Eric's shoulder. We brought them both down. It took us 2 days. And it's been 16 months. When I heard of the two most recent avalanche deaths and the near misses in recent times, I realized a couple things. I realized things are changing down there, so be careful. We need to do some work to make things safe for us to play down there still. But I have one secret kind of thought, and that is that Rowdy never left those mountains. And then when someone's caught like we were, that he's still there, and he provides some comfort in those last minutes to people. It's the only solace I can take from this. Thanks.
Mike Hopper. He shared that story at the April 2015 Dark Winter Nights live storytelling event in Fairbanks, Alaska. That story was produced by Colleen Wood and myself, Rob Prince. Sound recording by John Huff of Alaska Universal Productions. Story consultation by Lori Neufeld. Music by Thought Trade and Emily Anderson. Have you got a great true story from Alaska for Dark Winter Nights? We're working on putting together our next big live show, so contact us through our website at darkwinternights.com. Dark Winter Nights True Stories from Alaska is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Communication and Journalism Department, preparing the students of today for the complex world of tomorrow. I'm Rob Prince, and remember, these are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on Dark Winter Nights.